Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Ancient Art of Thinking for Yourself, The Power of Rhetoric in Polarized Times, by Robin Reams, narrated by Kim Nemi. Publisher's note: in this audio edition, you will hear references to visuals present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Introduction: A Bible Belt Upbringing. I was raised to be a Republican housewife. That may sound strange to you if you weren't born into a particularly political or religious household, but for people who grew up in a world like the one I come from, white, evangelical Christian, Southern, it was pretty normal, or at least typical. Religion and politics were indistinguishable from one another, and we were taught that a conservative point of view was the only right position to have in either realm. If Jesus could have voted, he would have been a far-right Republican, and only far-right Republicans truly loved Jesus. My dad was especially determined to teach us the right way to think about pretty much everything, from politics to pop culture, theology to fashion trends. Conversations at dinner consisted of him telling us what was wrong with the world and us correctly repeating his arguments back to him. But for me, it consisted of trying to find flaws or inconsistencies with his arguments and pointing them out to him. This might sound miserable to you, but believe it or not, I loved arguing with him. He liked it too. He loved watching me test my counter-arguments and debate tactics. When I was younger, he could always defeat my contradictory positions. But over the years, my oppositional instincts sharpened into reasonable arguments that tended to frustrate him. Somewhere along the line, it stopped being fun. It wasn't just that we disagreed with each other. It was that we didn't respect each other. That's not putting it strongly enough. We hated each other's viewpoint, and that filtered into what we thought about and how we saw one another. I thought his views on capital punishment were evil. He believed my adolescent feminism was immoral and irrational. I thought his perspective on social welfare was hypocritical, racist, and self-serving. He thought my changing views on religion were heretical and blasphemous. For both of us, the line between a bad idea and a bad person became very blurry. In my eyes, my father himself, and not just his arguments and ideas, was evil, hypocritical, racist, self-serving. In his eyes, I, and not just my arguments and ideas, was immoral, irrational, heretical, blasphemous. By the time he passed away, several years had passed since we had been able to have even a civil conversation. My relationship with my dad was a mirror for what was happening in the larger culture of America during those same years. When I was born in the 1970s, political polarization was at an all-time low. Now, nearly 50 years later, it is at an all-time high. A 2022 poll found that, when asked to identify America's greatest enemy, 40% of people named the opposing political party rather than a foreign nation like China, Russia, or Iran. In the run-up to the 2020 election, 89% of Trump supporters believed that a Biden win would do permanent harm to the country, while 90% of Biden supporters thought a Trump win would do permanent harm. We no longer object to ideas and arguments we disagree with. We object to the people who have those ideas and make those arguments because we see them as wholly bad. Another odd thing about the disagreements I had with my dad in the last few years of his life was that we always seemed to be certain that each of us was correct and the other was wrong. In an increasingly bewildering world, our certainty only intensified. My dad was certain that I was brainwashed by the universities where I was educated and eventually employed, and by the Gen X malaise that infected me and the people I surrounded myself with. and that my take on current events had been warped beyond recognition when I began reading the New York Times in college. It was the limited and selective exposure to exclusively liberal ideas, according to my dad, that made me believe the things I believed. And those things were simply, and certainly, wrong. He often called me a bleeding heart liberal and believed my political views were based on emotion rather than reason. That's why I shouldn't have been allowed to vote. Politics should be reserved for rational people with reasonable views. He believed that if I only spent time listening to the other side, I would come around to a better way of thinking. But my feminazi highbrow elitism kept me from even trying to listen. I, on the other hand, tended to believe that my dad prioritized abstract political commitments over his own lived reality, and that he favored idealistic and uncompromising responses to problems over practical and realistic ones. He voted for politicians who wanted to dismantle Social Security, even though eventually he couldn't have gotten by without it. When confronted with a dire political or social problem, the displacement of people after Hurricane Katrina, for example, or the homelessness crisis that erupted in the 1980s, he was more likely to think about ideals like individual responsibility, government intrusion, and self-determination than he was about survival, efficiency, response time, or cost. I also thought that my dad's limited exposure to people who were different from him hampered his ability to understand points of view that were radically different from his own. He lived in a homogeneous community of people who thought like him, looked like him, and voted like him. Aside from a tour of military service in the 1950s, he never lived outside the American South. Although he was an avid reader, he only read books that he knew beforehand he would agree with. He only listened to conservative talk radio or watched Fox News. He clung to his ideals in ways that I believe hampered him from understanding radically different ideas on their own terms. Like he did with me, I attributed his errors to a lack of exposure. As you can tell, our arguments went in circles. If he sent me a news story, I tended to think it had no merit because of the politics I assumed motivated it. And if I disagreed with his take on current events, he would chalk it up to the slant of my news source. I once showed him a study that found that Fox News viewers were less informed on current events than people who consumed no news at all, to which he responded, "That's just what I'd expect the liberal media to say." Both of us tended to believe information and analyses that came from sources that shared our political orientation and disbelieve those that didn't. My dad's preference for his favorite talk radio shows or Fox News was guided by his trust in that media's orientation. They were insiders in his worldview. But another way of putting it is that they reinforced his orientation. As for me, I might tell myself that my preference for the New York Times, The Guardian, or New Yorker magazine is informed by my high regard for their journalistic standards. It is. But I'm kidding myself if I don't admit that I also glean some satisfaction from many of their headlines because they bolster my own political orientation. A good way to sum up our differences is that what I thought was true he was convinced was false, and he thought my one-sided culture, community, and media consumption accounted for my errors, and what he thought was true, I thought was false, and his one-sided culture, community, and media consumption accounted for his. The way my dad and I eventually came to see each other is much the same way that people with opposing political viewpoints see each other these days. Our own side is completely right, and the other side is completely wrong. We are the good guys, they are the bad guys. Think about how it makes you feel when you hear, view, or read something that confirms your political worldview. How would you describe the sensation? What about when they deride, lambaste, or mock an opposing view? What kinds of feelings do you associate with this experience? For most of us, it feels good. It's satisfying. There's a surge of visceral bodily pleasure associated with hearing our own viewpoint confirmed and an opposing viewpoint mocked or undermined. Physical, emotional experiences like these are a good indicator that we're not thinking as carefully as we should be. They might also be an indicator that we're engaging in some circular reasoning, presuming to be true the very thing we wish to prove, and latching onto facts and details that allow us to prove it. While circular reasoning may be illogical, not all circular thinking is necessarily bad. As a matter of fact, a certain amount of circularity is an inevitable part of any interpretation or perception. So, despite the acrimony between my dad and me, the way we thought about the world and each other wasn't completely wrong. In order to understand anything at all, we have to possess certain pre-understandings, predilections, predispositions, and biases that make interpretation possible in the first place. When I read a novel, I generally scan the overleaf to get a sense of what the book is about beforehand. I do this not just to decide whether I want to read it. The scan also provides me with an interpretive context that will help me understand the book as I begin turning pages. Movie trailers provide a similar function. Yes, they are teasers that make us want to view the film, but they also provide a context that helps us process the film once we begin viewing. There's a term for this. It's called the hermeneutic circle. The point of the hermeneutic circle is to make us more aware of our predispositions and predilections that precondition and impinge on how we receive and interpret new information. Even though I have an idea of what a book is about from the overleaf, I shouldn't fully judge it by its cover. Maybe the overleaf helped me make sense of the first few pages, but I shouldn't let those initial impressions determine everything about how I read and interpret the book. In other words, the hermeneutic circle sees biases as inevitable and even necessary to understand anything at all. But it also sees them as a potential problem if our predispositions cause us to see things one way and keep us from seeing them another way. An even bigger problem is believing we could ever capture reality without some aspect of pre-interpretation, pretending as though no hermeneutic circle exists at all. The point of recognizing our own hermeneutic circle is to try to become more aware of it, nevertheless realizing that complete escape is ultimately impossible. The point is to recognize how those predispositions and predilections impact our interpretations so our understanding can be better, sounder, and less voluntarily skewed by our tendency to see things one way rather than another. This is something neither my dad nor I were very good at. We were so deeply dependent on our hermeneutic circles that we could scarcely step outside them. When we are overly reliant on our hermeneutic circle, it can guide us to only believe or listen to ideas that we trust because they reflect our particular insider orientation. In that case, we are not trying to be liberated from the hermeneutic circle. On the contrary, we are doing everything in our power to stay inside it. We are doubling down on our predispositions, making an even thicker barrier between ourselves and outsider ideas that don't conform exactly to our worldview. Like a Rorschach test, we don't see the thing itself. We see what our preconceived orientations predetermine we will see. Our distrust of them keeps us from questioning ourselves or examining our opinions. It compels us to avoid the kinds of critical analysis that would challenge us to form more accurate, truer opinions. It pushes us to intensify what we already believe and to adopt more extreme versions of our beliefs over time, whether or not those beliefs are grounded in truth or rationality. Here's the real rub. When we are overly reliant on our hermeneutic circle rather than critically aware of it, we end up prioritizing our own pre-existing beliefs over what is actually true, precisely in those areas where our pre-existing beliefs might be incorrect. In other words, when we cling like hell to our hermeneutic circle, it forces us to hide from ourselves the places where our perceptions might just be wrong. Over the course of 20 years, my discussions with my father went from playful debates to me thinking he was a bitter and irrational old man, and him thinking I had betrayed every moral value he had tried to instill in me. It makes me sad to think of how wide the gulf between us eventually became. And that gulf remains between my conservative family and me, where the line between a simple difference of opinion and utter moral suspicion is very, very thin. I know I am not alone in this experience. You, too, probably find yourself on the opposite side of a political divide from some people in your life these days. Holidays are probably more caustic than cozy. In the best case, you might simply avoid certain topics or people altogether rather than discuss things that will inevitably lead to contentious disagreements. The incendiary nature of politics today forces us to pick a side, to declare ourselves either insiders or outsiders in a group or community, and to commit ourselves to that group's dogmas. It becomes nearly impossible for us to talk to members of the other group, which our group believes are bad, wrong, dishonest, or dangerous. It's a bit strange that, in the political climate of today, we have such an intense predilection to automatically embrace our communities and social groups' political beliefs, almost as though doing so is necessary for our survival. We're liberal, so we feel compelled to think like a liberal, talk like a liberal, and embrace views that other liberals will approve of. Or we're conservative, so we feel compelled to think like a conservative, talk like a conservative, and embrace views that other conservatives will approve of. These are not just idle opinions. They involve our very sense of ourselves, who we are, our core identities and convictions. We commit ourselves to an ideology, and that abstract commitment often matters more to us than our immediate lived experiences. And although we may tend to think our political ideals are part of our immediate physical experience, in fact, they are not. Think of it this way. Have you ever seen capitalism walking down the street? When was the last time you ran across democracy in flesh and blood? What about socialism? Communism, totalitarianism, neoliberalism, republicanism, fascism, conservatism, liberalism, progressivism. The political ideals we hold dear, or passionately loathe, are never encountered in concrete reality because they are abstract. They exist at the level of ideas rather than in the physical world. This doesn't mean that our immediate lived experiences don't have political stakes and vice versa. They do. But those stakes have to be interpreted and defined. In the same way, our political ideologies have to be translated and applied to the material world. So when I say that our politics exist in our ideologies rather than in our realities, it means that the language of our politics matters. A lot. The things that we often think of as existing concretely, realistically, absolutely in the world are often very much a matter of language. As it turns out, there is a whole discipline devoted to the study of language. It's called rhetoric. I'm not exaggerating when I say that discovering rhetoric, the field in which I'm now an expert, quite literally changed my life. It helped me see how everything, from disagreements with my dad to the incendiary politics of our time to the way we think about truth itself, is propelled by the power of language. What is rhetoric? This question is hands down the number one question I am asked when I tell people what I study. It's also a question that would have been virtually unaskable at any stage of Western history before this one. That's because, after its invention in ancient Greece, the study of rhetoric dominated all formal education in Europe, the Near East, North Africa, and eventually America, up until the early 20th century. It was only about 100 years ago, virtually yesterday in historical terms, that rhetoric's importance diminished. At its inception, however, rhetoric was the science of language and persuasion. Some people think one of the earliest formal studies of rhetoric belongs to the Greek philosopher Plato, in his dialogue, The Phaedrus. In that dialogue, the character Phaedrus reads a speech about love from a scroll he has recently purchased. In delivering the speech, Phaedrus makes a strong case for an improbable position, that it is better for a person to go to bed with someone who doesn't love them rather than with someone who does. On first hearing the speech, Socrates is overwhelmed by its power, and he believes every word of it must be true, even though in his gut he knows it shouldn't be. As Socrates re-examines the speech more carefully, he begins to rethink his initial response. A long discussion ensues, where Socrates and Phaedrus pinpoint the speech's persuasive moves and its shortcomings. At the beginning of the dialogue, they are both completely convinced by the speech's power. By the end, they've reached a very different conclusion and have identified all the things the speech failed to do. But they've also identified why it had them so enraptured and persuaded upon the first delivery. This, in a nutshell, is rhetoric. By studying language, its many forms, figures, and powers, rhetoricians figure out how language works, why it is persuasive, and what makes people prone to believe it. In the beginning, rhetoric was intimately wed to both philosophy and politics. Rhetoric was tied to philosophy because both disciplines are concerned with how language relates to reality. It was tied to politics because, in the public arena, language can transform the way people see reality in ways that have practical, social, and political effects. Words can deliver reality to us, but words can also, as the philosopher and author of the first book on rhetoric, Aristotle, observed, warp the jury by leading them into anger or envy or pity, as if someone made a straight-edge ruler crooked before using it. Aristotle was particularly concerned about this crooked ruler because of the way it had been misused only a generation earlier, in the war with Sparta that led to the fall of Athens' democracy and the end of its political freedom. In the war, Athens had made one bad decision after another, spurred on by the power of words alone, in particular those of the Sophists, who you'll learn more about in the chapters that follow. Sophists were traveling statesmen who came from various corners of the Greek-speaking world and dazzled Athens with their displays of oratory and linguistic fireworks. Using the power of words alone, the Sophists could turn traditional views on their head and convince people of things that, in their heart of hearts, they knew were untrue. Followers paid outrageous sums in exchange for lessons in being able to use language the way the Sophists did. With such a weapon in their hands, Athenians who had studied with the Sophists could orate from the floor of the assembly and bend the will of their fellow citizens. It was this, more than anything else, that led to Athens' bad decisions and ultimate downfall in the war with Sparta. Initially, rhetoric emerged precisely because people wanted to understand how the Sophists had used language to wreak such profound havoc in the first place. I often take comfort knowing that, as much as it may seem like democracy today is in free fall and political strife has never been worse, these problems are not new. The Greeks experienced them long before we did, and their experiences were what compelled them to invent the discipline of rhetoric. I have studied ancient Greek rhetoric for nearly my whole adult life for exactly this reason. To me, it is neither a dead letter nor some imagined pinnacle of Western civilization, but a living, breathing apparatus for thinking differently. After Aristotle, and for nearly 2.5 millennia, people studied how to craft language and deliver persuasive speeches, and they studied all the techniques and tropes that make persuasion possible. The study of rhetoric consisted of exhaustive memorization of historical and literary texts and great works of oratory, learning all the different figures of speech, extemporaneously arguing and defending positions, and creating and critiquing one's own and one's rivals' speeches. These practices endured up to the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century, until writing replaced speaking as the dominant form of not only education, but also all forms of public communication, and rhetoric receded from view. Where it's remembered, it's a PG-13 version of its former uncensored glory. Perhaps you have a passing familiarity with the proofs of rhetoric. Logos appeals to logic, ethos appeals to the authority of the speaker, and pathos appeals to emotions. Or the five canons, the invention, arrangement, style, memorization, and delivery of a speech. Or possibly the genres, forensic rhetoric for reaching judgments in the courts, deliberative rhetoric for determining future actions in the assembly, and epideictic rhetoric for praising or blaming someone. Aside from these enervated remnants, what rhetoric once was in its grandeur, force, and full-throated power has been largely forgotten. In forgetting about rhetoric, however, we unfortunately also forgot about the things it once taught us. How and why certain words and modes of communication have the power to persuade us, and therefore to dictate our thoughts and determine our actions. When people study rhetoric, they come to understand these ancient things anew and remember what's been forgotten. People begin to study rhetoric whenever they take a step back from language to analyze it with a more critical eye, just like Socrates and Phaedrus did with the speech on love. Instead of thinking about whether they agree or disagree with the words they hear or read, people who study rhetoric consider the effects of those words, why they were chosen, and how they impact the way the argument lands. In other words, rhetoric is a meta-language that describes and explains how language works. Grammar is another kind of meta-language. The words noun, verb, and adjective are used to describe other words. Words that refer to people, places, or things. Words that refer to actions. Words that describe or modify people, places, or things, and so on. Logic is also a meta-language. When we use terms like deduction and induction, we are using language to describe the argumentative forms that language can take in the construction of logical proofs. Although rhetoric explains slightly more complex and inscrutable aspects of language use, it functions in much the same way as grammar and logic. It is unsurprising that grammar, logic, and rhetoric were studied together through much of their long history. Together, they were called the trivium, the original three liberal arts, and the foundation for all other fields of study. Rhetorical metalanguage offers ways of describing the various moves that occur in language and identifying what happens in language to make it effective and persuasive, or not. Terms that are now taught as poetic devices in English literature classes, such as alliteration, onomatopoeia, allegory, metaphor, simile, and so on, originated in the ancient works of rhetoric as rhetorical terms, as opposed to literary figures of speech. Before they were reconceived as devices that add literary flourish and stylistic embellishment, they were understood as powerful tools for persuading people's thoughts and influencing their actions. In addition to these, there were countless others. Hyperbaton, anaphora, chiasmus, simploque, not to mention argumentative strategies like stasis theory and common topics, the construction of proofs, methods of imitation and memorization, and many, many more. Rhetoricians once studied and mastered these and thousands upon thousands of techniques of language. Rhetoric contains all the terms and vocabulary that rhetoricians amassed through the ages to describe the techniques that make discourse and persuasion effective. rhetoric is abstract because, rather than identifying things like nouns and verbs, it identifies the
sample complete. Ready to continue?